Good evening, and how sweet it is that we get to sit together. It's so special, so sweet. There's a couple of words that kind of stuck with me this week, so I thought I'd share them with you to begin with. And one is, what we have been looking for is what is looking. What we have been looking for is what is looking. Now, for me, that was a shift. And then today, Randy quoted this to me out of Stephen Levine's book, but it was Who Dies, that book. It says, it's time for us to perceive ourselves as spiritual beings with physical experiences rather than a physical beings with spiritual experiences. That's just closer to the truth. And so we continue hanging out with the dreaded subject. No, I shouldn't say that. The subject of death. And you're so brave to be here and to follow these lessons. Somehow, with us all together, I feel safer with that topic. To make me feel safe. Not just because you're going to die too, but just because we're opening up to a can of worms. So we're preparing for our last moments, and anything I've read throughout the traditions about dying, I heard that moment or the last moments are the most important. I don't know that for sure. But we know that life really only lasts a moment. And then another moment arises and dissolves into the flow. So each moment is fresh. Each moment is fresh. And so we live our life from instant to instant, from moment to moment, really not really knowing what the next unfolding is going to present to us. Now, I keep getting a little anxious about that. What's next? What's coming down the road? You never know. So each moment is fresh, but it is what we bring to the freshness can cover this freshness. So that's why it's so important that we spend a lot of time looking and feeling about what we're saying to ourselves. Because actually, we're kind of interrupting life. No, we're not kind of interrupting life. We are interrupting life. And so the Buddha teaches us, well, let's see if we can experience directly what it's like when we don't interrupt life. And that's important because then one becomes more compelling than the others, and it's very supportive. But one thing we've already realized, because we've drawn our attention to this phenomena too, is that everything's impermanent. everything is impermanent except one thing. And that is that unchanging spaciousness in which all our changes float. And we touch it. We touch it all the time, but sometimes don't realize it. But we certainly do when we're quiet and still. And within this spaciousness, all the changes can be held. And again, it's experiential in the sense of, well, is that true? And so we have to try it. Is it true? But there's spaciousness with emptiness. Now, I know you've read or heard lessons about emptiness, and you might have the same response that I did when I heard that teaching was, what? Emptiness? I'm not empty. Well, we're not. We're not empty, and we're not hollow. But when we empty ourselves, all of life is there without interruptions, without us adding our 2 cents worth. And so the emptiness began to make a lot of sense to me, because we are the happiest, again, we have to find this out for ourselves, if we're just seeing and hearing and feeling and smelling and tasting and thinking. It's enough. Think, well, it doesn't sound like enough. How about Netflix? Well, we can watch Netflix in a spacious, conscious way. And that would be seeing and hearing. When we are knowing that we are experiencing this phenomena, we know it is empty of our opinions or the mean things we say to ourselves or how we spin out the past or worry about the future. But that empty awareness we are practicing with the mindfulness meditation to look through a very small lens. Because we're going inside, we're being quiet and we're still, and we're investigating ourselves. What is going on inside? And so this small lens with the help of concentration allows or enables, certainly did for me, to look in a narrow way what's going on. And it's very important. But with practice, with a small lens of perception, we can also perceive through a wider lens. And that's the spaciousness that we're touching. And spaciousness, or you hear big sky meditation or big mind, again, our perception widens. And for me, the mindfulness meditation enabled that. I'm not too sure, but I understand that some people can practice with big mind from the very beginning. I think it's Tezaneya, says, you know, how much concentration do you need? And so it's really shifted my practice, because I truly thought it was all about the breath. And so we add the big mind to our perceptions. And it's the knowing of these additions from the big mind that shows us we can maintain the awareness. It holds it. And so that was a short little lesson on emptiness, just to stir the pot a little bit, as if death is not going to do it for us. So let's talk about Stephen Levine's, what he suggests in the book that can enable us to come closer to the truth of that we're dying and that we all will die. Which is, for me, most uncomfortable. So we're practicing, which I never thought this was possible, dying while we're still breathing. Sounds like an oxymoron, doesn't it? So he says these are things, and these are things you have practiced in this meditation practice you've been doing. So it's not anything new, but Stephen reminds us that gratitude is a lot more impact with gratitude than we realize. And the Buddha sets us up with, there are 10,000 sorrows and 10,000 joys. But we also know that being a human being, we have this Teflon process of where we seem to hold on to the sorrows longer than with the joys. So again, this can impact us. Now, when we bring awareness to our joys, it's important to stay with them for as long as they exist. And everything has a life of its own. So the joy has a life of its own. But stay with it until it's gone, until it leaves. And then, of course, we don't want to go after it, because that's just more suffering. So there are some things that we can appreciate about life. And when this appreciation is part of our practice, it brings balance to those parts of the self that have cultivated attachment to our suffering. Oh, we love to suffer, some of us. Oh, woe is me. Suffer, suffer, suffer. And it's not going to go away, as you well know, regardless of what we do. But what the practice does, it teaches us how to relate to the suffering, to see its true nature. And be able to have a relationship where we're not adding suffering to suffering, to suffering, to suffering. Second arrow. First arrow, yeah, something happens. You're going to suffer. Second arrow is optional. Oh, woe is me. Let me have a dialogue about all this suffering. Suffering, suffering, talk about it. I grew up with people who just wanted to talk about their suffering. And it had a great impact on me. But they didn't want to put any effort behind what it really is. And so the practice enabled that for me anyway. But some of us are really attached to our suffering and causing us to feel victimized by life, making God's imagined dial tone all too appealing. So although we might suspect that gratitude would cause us to tarry or to grasp, it actually does the very opposite. It enables us to let go into life and death with an open heart. And when I mention an open heart, that's the spaciousness. So gratitude is the highest form of acceptance. It's not Pollyanna, not that kind of gratitude. That's pretense. But we're looking for the real. We're looking for the truth. So something happens. And some I've heard teachers say it turns to gold, or hell to heaven, or death to life. It broadens our understanding of what life is all about. So gratitude is the teaching. Where there is resistance, we discover only that it keeps us ignorant. Of course, if we've had enough acceptance to explore our non-acceptance, if we learn nothing but that resistance amplified our suffering, then we would be more inclined to understand what's actually going on. So that's the first thing he said, and like I say, that's not anything new we haven't heard in these teachings. But the second one is mind states. I mean, we have to figure out a way of what we're actually saying to ourselves all the time. And again, the quietness and the stillness enables us to see that clearly. And the more we practice, the more clarity comes. And so, what Stephen did, Levine, in his 1 year to live, he said, and this is nothing new either, even though really I haven't touched this with you as much as Stephen has emphasized, and it's a tool called noting. And all it is just being able to name what's going on, not a dialogue, but hearing, seeing, feeling. And when we can note what is actually going on, again, something shifts. We begin to not identify with what we're seeing, or hearing, or smelling, or feeling. Yeah, even feeling. Know how much nonsense we put around our feelings. Oh, Nita, you sound mean. No, but feelings have a true nature. And when we take those feelings as an excuse to be offended, then we lack the wisdom of what feelings are all about. feelings occur for everything we do with our six senses, including thinking. So our whole life is a composite composed of events and states of mind. We're just a walking, talking state of mind. And how we appraise our life from our deathbed will be predicated not only on what came to us in life, this is important, but how we lived it. So it's kind of like, remember Kabir say, now is the time. Don't wait. Now is the time to die. And I think the other part is, he says, do you think ghosts are going to do it for you after you die? What you see or what you have here, you will have as you're dying. So it sounds to me that all our unfinished business will catch up with us when we're dying. And our level of wisdom, again, will teach us how to relate to dying. So we die how we live, which ultimately define whether we believe we have a good life or a bad life. But again, it's not the good and the bad, it's how we relate to the joys, how we relate to the sorrows. It's just that simple. And we begin to see how we do that. And the only person that can shift it or have the right effort will be ourselves. So the attitudes of our mind is important. Not to criticize ourselves or say, oh, there you go again, bad person. No. The mind has a mind of its own, as you well know. So our job is not to criticize it or even celebrate it, but it's to know it. And, you know, the knowing of what's going on is so simple. Yet that is what it takes to be free from these things that it's a beginning, it doesn't happen instantly, that's causing us suffering. So he goes into memory. Oh, memory. And when you're 75 years old, soon to be 76, you have a lot of memory. And being an elementary school principal, retired, where I dealt with all kinds of people, there's a lot of memories. And there's joy, but there's also sorrows. Why did I do that? Why did I say that? You know, what a tight ass, you know. I often say, I wish I could be principal now that I've had 20 more years of practice. Would I do it the same? No. Nor would you, whatever job you have or whatever was your daily life. No, you wouldn't do it. Because the only thing that's real is this moment of who you are. And in order to appreciate that, we really, really have to see it. We have to bring it in. And so what are our memories? Now, we have good memories. Nothing's wrong with that. Bringing them into our hearts. Memories. If we just don't grasp at all. One of the things I've heard in the Sangha, and Sangha changes all the time, is, oh, I wish it could be like it was before COVID. We can't do this before COVID. COVID, it was here. And, you know, and to lament that it's not like it was 2 years ago, it's not wisdom. It's ignorance. No. It's fresh. It's new. And it's not like it was. Nor will it be a year from now. So can you see how we deal with changes? How we get stuck in, oh, that was nice. I hope I can hold on to it. Oh, I remember when we, and how we use memory, and you know, memory is, most of it's not true. I can tell you, most of it's not true because we don't have that capability. So we embellish or we forget. So it's important to know the true nature of memory. And so when we do that, then it softens. The memories aren't going to go away. But again, it's how we relate. It begins to soften the holdings and tension around the memory. Ah, hello, bad memory. I remember what you said. I remember what you did. Ah, memory. My heart was not open enough to do it more compassionately. Now, is that hard for me to say? Well, one time in my life, it would have been impossible to say. But can we not see the forgiveness of oneself, how it pulls us out of the prison of bad memories? And so I'm way over, and I'm not finished, and that's okay, because you know what? We'll pick up from here, because Stephen Levine had some other suggestions that might be helpful for us. And so I'll stop there. Thank you for being good listeners. And now we'll open it up to you.